Welcome to the Voices Podcast, where we are elevating voices who are reimagining faith.
I think Sola Scriptura has largely become about being sure we know who to keep out. You know, we're the gatekeepers, we know where the bad guys are, we're going to keep them out. It doesn't do great at inviting people in, like the mandate for the Great Commission to go out and baptize people and make disciples of all nations. That's an inclusive thing. Jesus, as a living God, does great.
Hey everyone, we are here today with Dave Schmelzer, who is the founder of Blue Ocean,
the writer of Blue Ocean Faith, which is a new book that came out in January, and we're so excited for him to be with us today. So, hey Dave, how you doing?
I'm great, Gary. Thank you guys for having me.
For sure. So this is a new question that I've started to ask people. So when someone asks you, what do? How do you describe it to them?
Well, it depends who's asking me. So I'm living in a place, the places I've tended to live have been really non-church going places, which is one of the main reasons I've lived there. And so to those people who say, what do? I usually say I'm the executive director of a nonprofit that works with churches that are trying to thrive in very non-church going places. Then to people who are like you in the know, I would have a different answer.
Very nice. Well, that reminds me, when we first started our church Bayshore in the Silicon Valley, I got weird looks from people when I said I was starting a new church, and they were like, oh no, I got to get out of this conversation. So then I had some other people say, well, what if you say like church startup? And it helped take the conversation, because, you know, there's so many startups up here that people are like, oh, okay, well maybe we're alike and we have some things in common. So I
say master of contextualization, to use a long word.
I know, it confused me. Like, what is that? That sounds exciting. That's a long title.
Excellent.
Right on, man. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your spiritual journey and how you ended up starting this organization, which we'd love to hear more about, Blue Ocean, and then we can move into your book from there.
Sure. So in brief, I did not grow up as a churchgoer. I grew up in Southern California in San Diego. And I, by my high school years, was sort of a amateur atheist debater. So I would find people of faith and sort of pick at them until they would fight me, and we would have our little verbal sparring.
Ooh, sounds exciting.
It was very fun. It gave me pleasure, and it gave me superiority because I always felt like I won. And I made my way to college, and early on in my college career, I heard some guys talking about being churchgoers, and I picked at them in the same way I picked at everybody else. But these guys, since they were college students, were a little bit more savvy. So they held their own in the conversation. I don't think I lost. I like to think I held my own, but it was not a clear victory. And then not long afterwards, I had I was just discouraged about life and where my life was headed, and I couldn't figure out how to cheer myself up. And so I thought, maybe the Christians are right. What do I know? So I prayed, and through a series of kind of quirky events, I began thinking, well, there's certainly something going on in the universe. I took a bunch of classes at my college about religion to try to figure out what that was that was going on. So I took a class on Sufi Islam and modern day Judaism, and my sister was a Taoist. So I talked to her and kind of tried to figure out what is this all about. I ended up, for reasons that are probably too lengthy to get into here, landing on Jesus as what it was all about.
All right.
And from there, ended up kind of pursuing a bunch of stuff, pursued the arts for a while, went to seminary, worked among the poor, did a bunch of things that led to me starting a church in Cambridge, Massachusetts, that ultimately kind of went big. So I was not even the person who was supposed to be the pastor. I was just there to help, but the pastor kind of quit. And so people looked to me, and we went live as complete innocents. We did not have any idea what we were doing. I had never read a book about starting a church. I had not been planning to do that. But there was just a really pent-up need. And so within a couple of years, we were the biggest church in town. And within 3 or 4 years, we were like way the biggest church in town and among the biggest churches in greater Boston. And that got some attention both in our denomination and kind of around the area. And we got a little attention from secular press. And so we spent a long time trying to figure out, what did we do exactly? And what's our explanation? And there was a bunch of explanations. Some of it just that we were in the right place at the right time seemed clear to me. But one of the explanations was that we had come in with a different set of assumptions for a very non-church going place. I think it's just about the most non-church-going place in the country. You guys in Seattle would be in that conversation as well. But we were up there, and I think kind of probably my atheist background helped me. That I felt, and my educated background, I was pretty educated, so I wasn't uncomfortable being around the Harvard gang. But we realized we just had a whole set of assumptions that were a little bit different than some people in our denomination whose churches were in rural or suburban or very church-going places. We just had kind of come at it from a different angle. And so we spent a few years trying to figure out what that angle was. I got invited to speak at a lot of places because if there's one thing, we were in an evangelical church at the time, and evangelicalism loves success. And so I became picture of the success in a very non-church-going place. So I was in hot demand for a brief period. And that helped me just process, so what did we do? I'd get invited to speak about what we did, and I would think, I don't think I know the answer, but what did we do? And with all that, we started trying to write things down. We convened a conversation among people both in and outside of our denomination about who were in very secular places, college towns, coastal towns, about what they were learning. And what we discovered was they were learning things that were markedly different than we were reading in the books that came out of the South or came out of Orange County, places that were very church-going. We just were learning different lessons. And so we started a conversation that probably involved a few hundred churches in it. I wrote an earlier book. I wrote a manual about kind of what we did when we were in Cambridge, which is now somewhat dated because I think even that's time moves on so quickly.
Yeah.
But that got us in a bunch of churches who wanted to talk. And ultimately, that conversation became more interesting to me even than pastoring our large sort of civic institution church in Cambridge. So we spent about a year trying to figure out who could be my successor. We found a wonderful successor. And then Grace and I moved to another very non-church-going place in a very different part of the world, to Santa Monica, California.
Oh, you lucky guy.
I know it. Well, you guys are in Seattle and you were in the Bay Area. Don't come whining to me about how old you.
Yeah, okay. That's true.
So, you know, and Cambridge was lovely. So we didn't move from a hellhole. We moved from a really dynamic, fascinating place. But, right, it's certainly lovely down here. But it's, you know, it's a different sort of secular. Also very non-church going, focused on communication, entertainment, and media, whereas Cambridge is focused so heavily on education. We just thought we needed to learn a different sort of secularism. And from that, a small network of churches has kind of come out of the very large conversation we were in to a very small network of people who just want to do this blue ocean thing. And so from that, we ended up trying to distill further. So what have we learned? And we tried to put it in a book, which you have since read and referenced, called Blue Ocean Faith.
Wow. So you just bounced between coasts, it sounds like here, huh?
We did there. It was a big move. I mean, I had, at the time that I moved, which is coming up on 4 years ago, I had five kids all at home. So there was just be willing to move them out of their world and to a very different place and trusting that God would meet us here. And, you know, there was financial risk, of course, leaving a very secure church job for a very insecure job in a very expensive place. But so far, so good.
Right on. Now, your church you were pastoring over on the East Coast, what was the background for that church? So you mentioned that you had this network of churches that started to have conversations. So tell us a little bit about the denomination you're part of or group or whatever that was.
I planted it in a denomination you might have heard of called Vineyard, an evangelical charismatic blend denomination that started in the late Jesus movement in the 70s. And so we started with them. Had a wonderful experience there. I think that what they were doing was just so helpful and so kind of focusing for us in the area. I think that's one of the real reasons we succeeded, is that we were trying to do what all Vineyard churches tried to do, which is to try to create a vibrant contemporary worship experience, which at the time was unheard of in the Boston area. Now there's many wonderful churches doing it because, as I suspect your own church does, it's become a much more common thing to do. But it was sort of uncommon when we started. And so that in itself, I think, helped us grow. What we found over 20 or so years of being a church among Vineyard churches was that there are areas in which we were a wonderful overlap, but Vineyard's roots were also fundamentalist. We're pretty conservative, and we were asking these really kind of progressive questions because we were in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And so our culture and our context had us constantly asking, but what about this? But what about this? But what about this? But what about this? And I think that became sort of an irritant to our denomination. So at one point I was actually up for national director and a national director switch in the denomination, but the gentleman who got the gig was sort of on my other end. I would have been on kind of the left of where Vineyard was, and he would have probably been on the right of where Vineyard was. And so with that transition, it was pretty clear that it would not be helpful for me to continue. because this, the questions we were asking really wasn't the mainstream of what Vineyard churches were asking, including questions about LGBTQ inclusion, which I know we're going to talk about here. Yeah. That was not a happy conversation there, and it was a central conversation for all the churches we were working with in coastal cities and urban centers. So we kind of went off on our own. The church that I pastored in Boston was called the Greater Boston Vineyard when I was there. It has since renamed under my successor. It's called Reservoir Church and is a dynamic church that if you're in Cambridge, you should definitely check out.
Right on. Okay, well, let's transition to your book and how you've distilled all of these learnings into something now that has been produced and more people can read and learn from. So I'm going to read the tagline to it because I think it'll be helpful to set some context for us. So for our listeners, the book is, again, called Blue Ocean Faith, and it is the vibrant connection to Jesus that opens up insanely great possibilities in a secularizing world and might kick off a new Jesus movement. That is money, by the way. Like, that was well written. So I give you props on that one because that's very engaging. So specifically in the book, I want to get at three different things that I think will really help our conversation move forward here. But the three that I really want to target on are this phrase, centered set, another phrase, third way, and then finally, soulless Jesus. So talk to us about what those mean and what you've learned about that over the past years.
Learn quite a bit about all three. They've all been so helpful, and they're conversations that just showing, I'm sure, what kind of nerdy people I and my friends are. We have chewed over all those three phrases for, I suspect, hundreds of hours. So let's start with centered set. The idea of centered set came to me through my previous denomination because the leader there had learned about it from an anthropologist at my seminary, Fuller Theological Seminary in California. A guy named Paul Hebert had come up with this idea some years back that then I think we probably took directions that Mr. Hebert, I'm not sure, would be happy we took it. We kind of pressed him far into it. But his original idea, he was a guy, he'd been a missionary, and so he became an anthropologist and was trying to think about how cultures worked, and he came up with this dynamic idea. And so the idea is picture two sorts of sets. One, if you see a piece of paper, you'd see a circle. This is what he would call a bounded set. And the issue with a bounded set, the circle, is just whether you're inside of it or outside of it. So there's a bunch of dots on that page. Some will be inside the set, some will be outside the set. But then there could be another sort of set. So you picture a different sheet of paper with sort of a big, bold dot in the middle. And there is no circle. There's also a bunch of dots on that page apart from the big bold dot in the middle. This would be a centered set. And the issue there is not being inside of or outside of anything. It's motion. Are you moving towards whatever the center of the set is, or are you moving away as if the other dots are moving? And even the center could move a bit, which I think if we're using Jesus as the center, which to foreshadow, I do, Jesus is alive. He's not a static intellectual concept who would stay fixed. Jesus is a living presence and God. And so probably the scriptural image to me that most helps me think about centered set is the parable of the prodigal son. So there, the wandering son leaves home and he says fooey to his father and going to live the high life. Things don't go well. He thinks, I can never go home. He finally thinks, I got to go home. I'm going to turn and offer to be treated like a slave. He turns back. And then immediately the father seemingly has been looking out the window and runs up, interrupts his little apologetic speech, hugs him, gets a feast. So to me, that's a centered set picture, because what it says is the center, Jesus in this case, is looking towards us. All we can do or help others do is turn towards Jesus. And as we help people do that, Jesus does the work. Jesus is alive. Jesus will interact with people. Jesus is not a static intellectual concept. And what we realized that was helpful for us as we were starting our church in Cambridge, and that it became central to that church, and I think central to all Blue Ocean churches, was most churches are going to be tempted to be bounded set, understandably. Meaning they're going to think, well, there's a set of things we believe. There are truths. And so either people believe them, in which case they're inside of our set, or even come to our church. They're physically inside a bounded set of a building. Or they're outsiders. In which case, we're benevolent. We believe in evangelism. We want people in our set. So we'll go out and try to get people out there into here. But the dynamic of that is vast. As I said, I've been in so many conversations about this, and I find this super helpful, that what people don't realize in bounded sets, and we all have bounded sets are just people like us, people we feel comfortable with. So I've moved from the East Coast now, And yet I am still a pretty rabid Boston sports fan. So I live in Los Angeles.
Wait, so you like the Bruins then?
Yeah, I like the Bruins well enough, although I'm not a hockey fan because I grew up in San Diego. So that's always been the lesser one, but I'm watching the playoffs now. Celtics, go Celtics.
All right. We'll take
They've been the rival to the Lakers, right? Where I now live, or the Red Sox and the Patriots, et cetera. And of course, people, I think, am I right that people really have a great affection for the Patriots around the country? Just have a kind of a warm hearted love of them? I think they do.
Generally not, especially in the Seattle area.
Yeah, well, Bill Belichick's kind of a warm-hearted, cuddly sort of guy, and I think people just kind of – he's kind of Santa Claus sort of figure for most. And it's all the same. I have a bounded set of, you know, Boston sports fandom. So I have a bounded set. We all have bounded sets. We have things we love. But what this is saying is that I think churches don't realize that bounded sets are often really cultural. What we're asking people to do is abandon their culture for your culture. And so you might say to a, you know – you're trying to invite a Bengali Muslim to join your bounded set church or your, you know, your wonderful church in Seattle or one of my churches. And what we would say is, hey, jump into our pool of blue ocean or of whatever it is. You'll love it. You get salvation. All you got to do is change some opinions about Jesus and you're good. And I think the Bengali Muslim rightly would say, that's all I have to do. I don't have to dress differently. I don't have to vote differently. I don't have to have different attitudes towards the opposite gender. I don't have to – there's a whole culture you'd be asking someone to leave. And I think what we've discovered is most people don't want to leave their bounded sets. You know, most people, that's not where they're at. On the other hand, if you were to say, well, there's Jesus. Look over there. It's Jesus. Check it out. And help people make a turn, lots of good things can happen that are not about in or out, right or wrong. One final quick point on the bounded set and set thing, and I know, Gary, you've thought about this, and I'd love to know your thoughts, and Kyle as well. The issue in bounded sets, it's very tempting to spend a lot of our time looking at the boundary. In other words, our focus is on where's that line of that circle. And what that usually boils down to is what is sin and what is not sin. And so we spend a lot of our time as leaders in a bounded set community thinking about, I've looked at the scriptures, this behavior is sin, that's sin, because that's why we know that people are not going to wander off into the land of hell or error or whatever it is. In centered set, our focus is towards the center, which is Jesus. And so it's a very, it ends up being quite different that you're really thinking a lot about who's Jesus? How do I know Jesus better? How do I help other people know Jesus? And I tend to like the one more than the other.
Okay. Now I've got a question about that. So I would imagine you've had a little bit of opposition to that framework and that idea that maybe somebody might say something like, whoa, 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 hold on. You're watering down the gospel. You are making it easy for people to be in. You can't do that. I mean, have you had that happen? And how do you respond to somebody that might say that?
You know, Gary, I have had that happen.
Once or twice, maybe.
I have. It's true. You're on to something big here. So I actually list in the book, in my centered set chapter series, like four fundamental objections that have tended to come up in my responses along those lines. And I think my main response is saying, well, one, I think between you, me, and our listeners, I think the difference in the end isn't an intellectual difference. It's almost a heart level difference. It's for people who kind of yearn to think, that sounds awesome. I just want to follow Jesus and help others follow with me at a heart level. I think centered set works great. What I've discovered is, and I can go into some of the specific objections, which I certainly have thoughts about, but I've discovered that for people for whom there's a heart level objection of like, I don't like that, there's nothing I can say. Because what I found is I think people who have a heart level objection like the boundaries. They like feeling like I'm right and those people are wrong. And I know I'm right. I thought this through. I've got good apologetic arguments. I've worked through the scriptures. I know I'm right. And there's such a hunger to feel right over against other poor, benighted people who are wrong, that's a very difficult thing to give up. And I think centered set sort of asks us to give it up, to say, I don't know, it's about being right. It's about my experience. My experience is there's a living God who might help you, helps me. And so it calls for a certain sort of humility that is appealing to some and I don't think appealing to others. In terms of the arguments we find ourselves in at points, for people to say you're watering down the gospel, my question is, which gospel are we talking about? The gospel you're describing, the God I hear you preach, isn't the Jesus I've come to know. It's a God who's very concerned that we don't screw up. And I somehow feel like, I don't know, the God I've met, when I pray, that's not the God who talks to me. He says, Dave, you haven't screwed up today, have you? You're not believing the wrong stuff. You're not a bad person. Quit being a bad, be a good person. I am more on the Brother Lawrence God, where you go to this God and he says, you're my favorite. I love you. You're awesome. Let's fall. Let's go together. Let's move. So I just think it's a different experience of God in some cases.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, even in recent conversations I've had, that way of thinking, it's, I don't know. I have these questions sometimes of like, how did we get to what we actually have as what we might call Christianity, evangelicalism, all of that, that is so bounded to a certain set of ideas and beliefs that you have to make sure you get right, as if God's like the cosmic bouncer waiting up there, like, you get it all down? Oh, whew, cool. I don't have to burn you. That's great. You know, like how did we get there with this picture of Jesus that we do see in the Gospels of, I mean, I love that you even talked about the prodigal son. I feel like there's so much power in the imagery and the love that you see as a part of that story that I hope that we can begin to accept and bring forth into a new way of thinking about what faith looks like.
And I would say I totally couldn't agree more. And I think I'm thinking of one of my more heated conversations I've ever had on this subject. That was, I'll bring you into the drama of the heatedness in a minute, because that's always good fun.
Oh, yeah. But
the only reason I bring it up is to say it was clarifying, because I realized the fact that my opponent was so invested and so heated in his opposition to Centered Set, and I felt pretty heated in my defense of it, was revealing. So I thought, oh, so what's at stake for you? And then I realized, well, here's what's at stake for me. And so we both mutually called each other heretics, almost as one. You heretic. And that's always a very helpful way to start a friendship. And where we were headed was, I was a heretic because I wasn't defending all the boundaries of the faith as being super important. I wasn't saying, oh, I believe X, Y, and Z, and this is important. I'll defend this boundary forever. And in his world, everybody did that. Everybody. And so the fact that I was uninterested in that, I was outside of faith. But the reason I almost as one called him a heretic is I said, so you don't believe in a living God. In other words, you don't believe that Jesus is alive, from what I'm hearing. And what he said was, it's dangerous to have Jesus as alive because that's subjective. I'm not subjective. I'm objective. Yeah. I have the right answers. And I said, well, there we have our difference. I know Jesus. And I actually think I'm on the side of the great saints. I can quote you endless saints throughout church history who are on my side in this debate. So you're a heretic.
That is great.
But that was the issue was, are you defending the right stuff or do you know Jesus? And that kind of became the stakes.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I think that's a really cool way to think about it, that it kind of, I don't know, I think it opens up Jesus to a wider audience of people. So, sure. So I'm interested in moving on to the third way. So I've heard this described a few different ways before, but I would love to hear for you, what is the third way movement and have you seen that played out in the Blue Ocean?
The third way is both completely promising and gripping and completely difficult, and we'll see if it works. It's hypothetical, though we think it comes from the Bible, so that gives us hope.
The amazing experiment here.
Yes. So third way is an attempt to help church people navigate really difficult conflicts that are splitting church people apart profoundly, not minor conflicts, not like I like that type of worship music, but you like that type of worship music. Those would be opinion. Which I think we can find our way through, but really fundamental questions. And so the case in point, the test case in the recent world has been, how should we think about our LGBTQ congregants? Are they congregants like every other congregant and they're just people in our church like everybody else and they can do what everybody else can do, they're just people? Or is the Bible clear that there's a sinful behavior which they have to be kind of confronted with up front? And there's limits to how far an LGBTQ congregant could hope to rise in your church or your movement of churches. Which is the right answer? And as you guys know, because we've talked about it, this is just a major, major conflict among all churches, I think, right now, trying to figure it out. So some denominations they feel like they've gotten past it. Some denominations are hanging tough in a conservative viewpoint. It's very important not to let the evils of a new thought in. How do you navigate that? Well, the idea of the third way comes from Romans chapter 14, where Paul was dealing with conflicts too that he was describing, eating meat sacrificed to idols and are some days different than other days. I think to those of us now, they can feel like those were nothing. I mean, come on, we got real issues. Who cares? Meat sacrificed to idols? I'm not really dealing with that question. And days, I don't even know what you're talking about. But for him, I think those were equally central. So meat sacrificed to idols were, he was in Rome, meat was butchered then, and all meat, I think, was offered to a god as part of the butcher's code, you know, to a Roman god. Well, about two-thirds of the Old Testament is heavily against that plan, saying that's basically being a pagan. That's intermixing your worship of God with pagan evil demons. And so meat sacrifice idols was a biggie. The days that they were talking about, I think, was the Sabbath day. Do you need to celebrate the Sabbath? Which was one of the Ten Commandments, kind of a big deal. And the people who took the conservative viewpoint were mostly observant Jews. And the people who took the, come on, this is all ridiculous viewpoint, were the converts who'd come from the Gentile world, who said, meat sacrifice to idols, if those are, you know, if I don't even think those are gods, it's nothing. It's just, it's what people I don't even agree with do. I mean, what do I care? I'm going to eat meat. You can't make me a vegetarian over that. That's ridiculous. It's your deal. But for the conservative people, it's like, I got the Bible on my side. Look, I got all these verses.
Yeah.
And so Paul was trying to help people navigate such a difficult distinction. And I think his way through, I think, if I'm understanding it, was this. I think what he said is, if you're on the conservative side, what you can't do is demand that people on the liberal side outside of your presence agree with you. So you people on the progressive side, if meat sacrifice to idols is a big deal to your conservative friends, then when you're with them, please don't eat meat. Be a vegetarian with them. But the deal is, on the conservative side, you cannot tell the progressives, don't eat meat in your own home. We got to disagree that this is a tough one. It'll work itself out. And it talked about dynamics. It said, if you're on the progressive side, you're going to be tempted to look on the conservative people as foolish. They've got this crazy religious concern that you can't even relate to, and you're going to have some contempt for them. And it basically says, don't have contempt for them. They're working through their own thing. That's not cool. But on the other side, the conservatives looking towards the progressives, you're going to be tempted to shout at them they don't even know God at all, or they would agree with you. That's off limits. This is a real distinction we're all trying to work through. So the theory of the third way, for instance, as applied to the controversy over LGBTQ congregants, is that you got to agree we can all live in the same place with some provisions. And the basic provision is that every point of view is welcome, because it's the whole Church of Jesus Christ is working this out right now. It's not clear that one is obviously right or wrong. It's being worked out, as controversial things tend to do. But the kicker for the conservative gang is that you cannot keep anyone out who agrees to abide by the rules that Paul set out. So that means people who are LGBTQ are welcome in your congregation. They're entirely welcome at all levels. They are just congregants like everybody else. So if somebody gets married, they can get married, a very controversial thing. Yeah. If someone gets ordained and they're appropriate to be ordained, they can get ordained. We're in this conversation, and no one is being restricted or excluded, is the third way. As you would guess, that's a toughie. And I think what we've discovered is, in implementing the third way among Blue Ocean churches, it's loved. So in that sense, if you were to talk to anybody in any Blue Ocean church, they would be down with the third way, very excited about it. But what you would find is there is a small percentage of people who hew to a more restrictive perspective who are still in those churches happily, and a good deal of them leave. Because if you're restrictive, obviously, and the deal of third way is that you can't exclude anybody. Well, if you can't exclude them and you're bounded set, what you're doing is you're letting the evils from the outside of your set into your set, which corrupt it. And so if you're committed to a restrictive perspective, you have to leave. So anyway, there it is. That's how we've tried to work things out. We're still figuring out if it works.
Nice. So it sounds like being a third way church and holding a centered set viewpoint go hand in hand.
They do. They are part and parcel. It's just a way. It's an application of centered set to controversial issues.
Yeah. And even as you describe that idea, it's, gosh, it's, you know, you're dealing with people. And so how are you seeing this work in real life in churches to try and live this third way? I mean, do you have any examples of some really great stories of some movement forward? Yeah,
I do. But while not denying it's hard, it's not a way. You don't get to dodge the hard parts of this by third way. It doesn't get you out of that. You're still in hard conversations. But what I have found, so for instance, we've just started kicking around a very kind of fledgling new Blue Ocean congregation that I'm leading in Santa Monica with my wife, Grace. In that congregation, I can think of two people who are dedicated attendees of our church, who love it, who I get together with for coffee, one dropped by my house today, who are conservatives in most ways, who are conservatives on the LGBTQ question, who are probably politically conservative. At least one of the two is an ardent Trump voter in a sea of non-Trump voters, which would be a lot of our congregation. And yet really loves our church, well knowing no one has had to be covert. So who I am, I think this woman who's, I would describe as the Trump voter, ardent conservative, she's hip to, she's tracking. There's no secrets. And so the fact that they can stay with us happily and say, I want to do this, I'm excited about this, let's make this thing happen. It feels like a little miracle, right? I mean, how's that possible?
Yeah, totally.
How can the Trump and the non-Trump folks hang out? how can a person who takes a conservative stance on LGBTQ kind of theology watch us as we have, you know, once you start being a third way church, you get a disproportionate percentage of LGBTQ people who show up because they want Jesus. And they've been kicked out of every church that believes in Jesus except yours. So they tend to come. So we've got leaders in our church who are out lesbian, out gay. And so you've got people now who are conservatives who they're looking at that. How can they stay happily? I think they can stay happily because they believe Centered Set and they personally experience the benefits of Centered Set. And they realize, yeah, I could just go to a church that's going to be tough, you know, and be tough in the ways I believe. I don't actually want to be in that church. I don't even like the fruit of it. I don't like how it feels to be in that church. I like being in this church. It just feels good. And so even as a conservative, they seem to be able to feel good and happy.
Yeah. And I feel like, I mean, the thing that's so attractive to me about that concept and what you're up to in really being one of the leading voices to try and help churches do this is, I guess my experience is we really only change when we are put in positions and change and grow when we're put in positions where we have to really work through some tension and disagreement. And I think as I've on my journey, what I've realized is that it can be really easy for churches just to be this constant feedback loop of just telling you the things you already believe that are correct and just keep like kind of patting like, good job. You believe all the right things rather than saying, hey, here's some other ways of thinking. Let's talk about that and wrestle with it and figure out what we think. And you can land where you're going to land, like no big deal, but we have to learn to live in community and love the other that might be very different than who I am.
And I think what you realize in Centered Set is that it's a whole new idea. In Bounded Set, I think it's very important to feel like you're with people who believe what you believe and that believing what you believe is an important thing. So I think of a number of evangelical friends of mine who lead churches where they talk at length about things like a biblical worldview, which I've come to realize is just shorthand for we figured out what's sin and what isn't sin and we have the right opinions about that question.
Yeah,
that's
exactly
a biblical worldview. And in Centered Set, all you're thinking about is, wow, I want to get to know Jesus. How do I do it better? Is it working for you? How's it working for you? Hey, help me out here. Can I help you out here? Hey, it's Jesus over there. Let's follow him. There's not much time spent thinking about I'm right and you're wrong. And I think just that feel is such a different feel that even some conservative people like that. And they think, yeah, I kind of like being in this world. So I'm free to hold the opinions I hold. I just can't tell anyone else they can't come and find Jesus here.
Yeah, that's great. So let's go into the last one that we wanted to talk about today. So soulless Jesus, what does that mean? Did you make up a word there? I'm just curious.
Actually, it's genuine Latin, and I'm pretty sure Jesus is a word that people have used in the past.
No, got it. Sure,
those are two words put together that did exist before we stumbled upon them. So you would be familiar as thoughtful people who have been church leaders that Protestantism was created around some statements that happened in the Reformation from Luther and Calvin and Zwingli and others, which were super formative in shaping both the modern world, in the Western world, at least in almost every respect, and super formative in shaping what became Protestantism. And they got put into Latin formulation, since the soul thing. And the one there's been some important ones, you know, so for Lutherans, sola fide, justification by faith only, not by works of the law, became just central. That it's our belief in Jesus, our faith in Jesus, whatever that means, that gets us to heaven. It's not good stuff we do, which those rotten Catholics were saying. And so those distinctions became the way to shape this new movement. And certainly all very important, and I'm thumbs up on the spirit of it all. In my sphere of the world, and perhaps yours, of evangelicalism, one of the solas became preeminent. And it was this one called Sola Scriptura, and a very important thing it was trying to do. What Sola Scriptura was trying to do was it was saying, well, what's the basis? How do we know who God is? How do we even know who we should be listening to about who God is? How do we even know how to read the Bible and what's it supposed to mean? And the way that the Catholics of the era were saying is, well, there's this thing called apostolic succession, and the current leaders of our church descended from Peter in this line of succession. So we have the right to tell you what the Bible is, and we're going to be the people to tell you who God is and how to follow God. Well, that was becoming absurd by the time Luther showed up, because these people were obviously corrupt. And so he just thought, I'm in crazy land. You know, he's a monk, and he's thinking, I'm loyal, but it's crazy to say that obviously corrupt people are the voices of God, and that I should be looking to them just because of this sort of hypothetical, abstract, apostolic. Are you crazy? I now have actually read the Bible. The Bible actually isn't even talking about what you're doing. I mean, your behavior, your opinions, almost everything is different. I'm going to stick with the Bible. And so he and others came up with this formulation they called sola scriptura. The Bible is the authority for how we should think about God and who we should believe, not some fallible person. Well, on the face of it, what's to argue with that? That sounds awesome. They were in a great position to make that point because the printing press was just coming into vogue. And so before that, it'd be difficult to make that case because no one was literate. And the Bible couldn't be read, really, by anyone. But they had a vision to say, give it 100 years, and everyone's going to be able to read it. And then we can all be our own priest. We can all go to the scriptures and know how to follow Jesus because the Bible will tell us. Again, I've been a huge beneficiary of that. I have done how many thousands of hours of group Bible study. I've preached my 1,000 sermons all from the Bible, and it has shaped me. And so, yay for sola scriptura, I'm helped. Here's the downside. What we discovered, I would say, in the last century, it's begun to kind of escalate, and increasingly it's escalated, is that, well, just saying the book is our guiding point, Jesus actually never said that. It was the Pharisees who were making that point, that we know the law, follow the law, and Jesus was messing with that. Paul messed with that. Paul was not sola scriptura. Jesus was not sola scriptura. The enemies were. And so what they were saying is the people who are the most important are what they called in the biblical era the lawyers. It's the people who look at the law and tell you what the law says. It's people who kind of dance on the head of a pin of what's right and what's wrong. It's bounded set. And sola scriptura, I think, has had that effect, at least in my beloved background of evangelicalism. It's become all about who is right about what's sin and what isn't sin, the very thing I'm trying to get past, and I think my friends are trying to get past. I think sola scriptura has largely become about being sure we know who to keep out. You know, we're the gatekeepers. We know where the bad guys are. We're going to keep them out. It doesn't do great at inviting people in, like the mandate for the Great Commission to go out and baptize people and make disciples of all nations. That's an inclusive thing. Jesus, as a living God, does great. And so we realized increasingly in our evangelical setting, sola scriptura was actually shutting down a living God. And I feel confident in that because I've talked to so many pastors. I've heard so many thousands of sermons. And it took me forever to realize in all these hundreds of sermons I was hearing, how often was Jesus as a living force talked about? And in evangelical churches, the answer was some very small percentage. It was, you know, 4%, but in 90-something percent, a biblical worldview, what's sin and what's not sin, was right at the forefront. How should you think about something was right at the forefront. And so we realized is, I think centered set, right? You've got the center of the set, it's Jesus, he's alive. If you turn towards him, he does great things. He can take it from there. Depends on a focus on Jesus, not a focus on parsing of words. And so with a great love of the scriptures, Blue Ocean leaders tend, in my experience, to be more passionate and eager to talk Bible than anyone I've ever met. So it's not a rejection of the Bible, just like Jesus never rejected the Bible and Paul never rejected the Bible. But the focus is on there's a living God who wants to guide us. Let's figure out how to do that. Hence, solus Jesus. And so we talk at some, I about to say some length, although it might be superficial in the book, about, well, here's some markers of how do we know we're turning towards Jesus to guide us. And the Bible's a part of that story, and we include ways that's true. And other people are part of that story. But it's a more humble endeavor of not saying, I'm certain, I figured out the Bible, and I know who's right and who's wrong. It's a humble endeavor of saying, we're trying to figure out who Jesus is, but Jesus is our God. The Bible is not our God. It's a wonderful aid, but not God. That's more what the Pharisees thought.
That's so interesting. So it sounds like you and Blue Ocean have made this big shift from sola scriptura to solus Jesus. What like kicked that off for you? What sort of made you go, wait a minute, maybe this like worship of the Bible is maybe not the best way to read the Bible? Was there something specific that kind of kicked that off for you guys?
You know, everything's interrelated. And so we centered set kicked it off for us as we began thinking about what's the implication of needing to look towards the living Jesus rather than the right interpretation of what's sin and what's not sin as our basis. That seemed very different. And that kind of had an escalating conversation. And we started just talking about what's working in your churches and the enthusiasm people felt, often very, very secular, sometimes very educated, sometimes not very educated, people finding Jesus with great enthusiasm by the droves in many churches, our own in Cambridge being one, and telling us what they found was not like, I was always wanting to know the right answer to a Bible opinion. What they were saying was, I just wanted Jesus, and you showed me, he's alive. I'm turning towards him. He's guiding me. And we asked all these questions like, yeah, but if the, you know, without sola scriptura, what if their lives become in error? You know, what if they start living wrongly? What if they think, you know, they're deluded? It's all so subjective. They say they know Jesus. How do they know they know Jesus? The Bible is going to be the objective answer. We discovered that was a false worry. that the people we found who found Jesus, and they started behaving sacrificially, giving generously, making big decisions in their lives, choosing community, you know, it's just all the things you'd want to see a disciple of Jesus do. And when I was talking to my Sola Scriptura friend, they were constantly saying, no one here gives. We had like, among our group of churches, we had like twice as much money per average giver as almost anybody. And we didn't teach giving that much. People just gave.
That's fascinating. Wow.
We had people, I think we were the number one in of the 500 plus churches, we had the most per person giving of anybody that I was aware of, at least as I talked to the larger churches. And we had people making radical choices, whereas what I would hear from my Sola Scriptura friends is, nobody does anything. What a bunch of lazy, no goodness.
Oh, that's hilarious.
You know, you guys have people making, you know, moving to community, starting churches, starting ministries, just doing stuff. And we thought, yeah, I think it's because we're Sola's Jesus, because Jesus is trustworthy, that if you turn yourself to him, he takes it from there wonderfully.
Oh, it's so good, man. Dave, I feel like we could sit and chat and I just would be like, we just need to sit and take notes right now. Like, this has just been so awesome. So we're getting to the end of our time together. So we're wrapping it up, man. Just tell us how we can learn more about what you're up to and the books you've written, both, you know, the newest, but also the ones in the past. Like, just give us a little info here.
You could look in a variety of places. So there is a national Blue Ocean Faith website at blueoceanfaith.org. That would be a place to start. You could pay attention to our Facebook page at Blue Ocean Faith and on your Facebook. That would have stuff. We have a weekly podcast where we're I and a Blue Ocean friend from Iowa City who's at the university there and also Blue Ocean pastor kind of kick around either things we're thinking about or things in culture. So again, we'd say the New York Times religion reporter I was mentioning to you on just today I was interviewing, our religion editor. And to learn about faith in the world in general. So you could listen to our weekly podcast, Blue Ocean World, available at iTunes. That would connect you. I do have a new book out, as you mentioned, this Blue Ocean Faith book on Amazon and elsewhere. Those would be places to start.
Right on. We love shameless plugs around here at Voices. So again, man, thank you so much for spending some time with us today. We really appreciate it. And we think this is going to be one of those conversations we're going to keep talking about moving forward. So yeah, thanks again so much.
Gary and Kyle, thank you. Great to be with you.
All right, man. We'll catch you later.